Thank you. I'd like to take the opportunity to thank the organizers for allowing me to participate in this nice program. So there is some connection to between what I'm talking about and geometry, one of the topics of this conference, as well as field theory. And I'll try to make that clear as I go along. And the rough outline of my talk is as follows. I was told to be pedagogical, so actually this is mostly taken from colloquium that I have given, so it's going to be really very sort of introductory. And in particular, I spent some time setting the background for the Casimir force, what its origin was, and why it is now becoming more experimentally accessible and relevant. Of course, the Casimir force is due to quantum fluctuations, but from the perspective of a statistical physicist, fluctuations are fluctuations, and you could have thermal fluctuations also giving rise to similar effects. And I'll discuss a particular system where the effect of thermal fluctuations is very nicely illustrated, which is superfluid films. And this is one of the first cases where we will see the effects of stochasticity and fluctuating interfaces and geometry becoming relevant. They are actually very important to describing the results of this experiment. The work on superfluid films originated with a former graduate student, Hao Li, currently at UCSF, and more recently with Roya Zandi and Joe Rotnick at UCLA. Now, this leads naturally to thinking about more complicated geometries, such as corrugated surfaces, and how the Casimir force between parallel plates is modified when you have corrugated surfaces. And we will see that this leads to modification of the normal force as well as sideways forces that have now been experimentally verified also. And this work was in collaboration with Thorsten Emig and Andreas Hanke, former postdocs at MIT. And thinking about fluctuations in space and the form geometries also leads to thinking about fluctuations in time. What happens if rather than having static plates, you have fluctuating plates? And this leads to thinking about dynamic Casimir effects, where you could have force and radiation coming related to moving plates. This work was done mostly with Ramin Golestanian, who is now at Sheffield University. And I finished with more recent work that has been in collaboration with Professor Jaffe at the Center for Theoretical Physics at MIT and two new graduate students, Scardiccio and Hertzberg. And the two pieces of work that we did that, one of them is related to calculating the force between a cylinder and a plate, and also for a different geometry that we call a piston, which brings about the issue of whether or not one can have repulsive versions of Casimir forces. Okay, so let's go on and start with Mr. Casimir himself, who back in 1948 considered the following problem. He said, let's imagine that you have two parallel conducting metallic plates, conducting metallic, same thing, and nothing in between, just a vacuum. But we know that the electromagnetic field can exist in vacuum, and in particular, if you think about solving for the electromagnetic field between these boundaries, the wave vector in the, that is normal to the plates has to be quantized in multiples of 1 over h. Okay? Now, also, for each one of these modes, you can define a corresponding frequency, which is simply the speed of light times the magnitude of this wave vector. And what Casimir pointed out is that now quantum mechanics produces an interesting effect in that each one of these modes can be regarded as a harmonic oscillator of frequency omega. And according to quantum mechanics, a harmonic oscillator even at zero temperature has an energy h bar omega over 2. So what Casimir did was that, well, we have to sum up all of the ground states, energies of all of these different oscillators that can exist for these quantized values of n over h and arbitrary values of kx and ky. And when you add up all of those energies, you will get an infinity. Now, the insight of Casimir was that actually the infinity has a piece that changes if the separation between the plates is varied. And so hidden in this infinity is actually an H-dependent part, which has a very nice form. Since I had the H-bar over here and the C of light, so it should be proportional to H-bar C. You expect this to be extensive in the area, so it should be proportional to area. H-bar C has dimensions of energy times length. So to make the dimensions work out, you have two powers of length here, energy length here. You have to divide by length cube. And the natural length that you have in the problem is h. So the dimensional form sort of give you these things. They don't tell you about the sign and the magnitude of this term, which is what Casimir calculated. Actually, there's a very nice article in Wikipedia that tells you about all of these things. I don't know why we bother to sort of give seminars. Everything is in Wikipedia these days. It even has a very nice pictorial illustration as to why people think this is an attractive force, because there are some modes that are excluded from between the plates, but then there's pressure from the outside the plates that forces them together. Not only that, it even gives you some details of how to do the regularization the way that Casimir did, using the Riemann zeta function and zeta function regularization, and actually mentions that there are alternatives for regularization in terms of exponentials in energy, etc., which is really the top version that we usually consider. Okay? So for the technical details, I refer you to Wikipedia.
So you didn't write it then?
No. People much more informed than me. Right. Okay. So there is this attractive force, again, proportional to h bar c, bars off as h to the fourth. Now, pretty much after, very soon after, Casimir suggested this in 1948. There were attempts at experimental verification to see whether this force existed. And in the West, the person who did most of that and was a pioneer is Barney. And in the Soviet Union, Deryagin did a lot of that. And actually, Barney sort of concluded by saying that essentially, given all of the uncertainties he had at the time, he could say that the experimental results were not inconsistent with the prediction of theory. So the early experiments were kind of at the accurate doing things as an order of magnitude, if you like. Part of the difficulty that Barney already noted was how to keep the plates parallel to each other. Deryagin overcame this, but rather than thinking in terms of two parallel plates, you think in terms of a sphere and a plate, then you don't have to worry about the parallelism. That's the geometry that most people have been considering. And actually, he was looking not at metallic plates, but silica plates. And probably one of the better, within 50% accuracy, experiments confirming the Casimir effect between metallic plates was done by von Blokland and Overbeck in the 1970s. And so that's where the state of the experimental art stood. And for roughly 20 years, then nothing happened. And then suddenly a new era of high precision experiments started, actually originated with Sparnay himself suggesting that the experimental methodologies that people had developed for atomic force microscopy, piezoelectricity, etc., could be very useful to go back and look at this problem. And the first high precision experiment was done by Stephen Lamoureux, and he again used the sphere plate geometry, measured the force in the range 0.6 to 6 micrometer. And just to give you an estimate of what you expect, the force per unit area, so it's kind of like a pressure, at the micrometer range is of the order of 10 to the minus 2 dyne per square centimeter, which is units that I don't particularly like. I prefer newtons, etc. Roughly, to give you dimensions, typically people are working at separations that are in the micrometer range, maybe 10 times smaller, 10 times bigger. So we range from 10 to 100 nanometers to 10 micrometers. The size of the objects or the areas or the radius of spheres, etc., are typically 100 times larger. So we are talking about millimeter ranges. And the forces that are measured subject to that area and separations range in the nanometer to picometer scale. Piconewton scale, nanonewton to piconewton scale, which if you convert it to pressure at the smallest distance is of the order of, say, 1 to 10 atmospheres. And at micrometers is of the order of 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 5 atmospheres. Okay, so anyway, he has some interesting experimental setup. In his case, actually, the difficulty is to make sure that there is no net charge remaining between the plates, and he measures forces in dynes as a function of separation. And he says that you're sort of within 5% of what is expected theoretically. So again, the force here is of the order of, again, this scale that I mentioned, nanonewtons to piconewtons, separations of the order of micrometers. Okay. The next set of experiments, just one year later, is again, I guess we go back to the beginning of this, is from Mohyeddin and Roy at UC Riverside. They use the atomic force microscope. They measure things at somewhat smaller scales, between 0.1 to 1 micrometer, and they claim accuracy at the level of 1%. Just to give you an idea of the setup, what they have is something like a sphere. They have a cantilever that once the plate is made closer to the sphere gets attracted to the plate, the cantilever deflects. The deflection is monitored by the reflection of a laser. So you can convert all of that to a force as a function of separation. And again, just to sort of give you an idea, these are the force scales, piconewtons, hundreds of piconewtons at this separation, and the theoretical curve goes through them. This was 1998. Now they have much more accurate data and much better precision. Okay? So, again, there's another one. By group at Stockholm, either. Here they go to even somewhat shorter distances, 10 to 100 nanometer. And I guess the geometry that is looked at here is between something that looks like two cylinders. Essentially, they have two surfaces that are kind of coming down and locally look like a cylinder, and they are put at 90 degree angle. And again, this is another geometry for which the force is confirmed to reasonably small distances.
Can you calculate anything from this geometry?
I'll come to all of that, yes. Not exactly, so that's part of the issue of why geometry is important to think about. And there are some approximations that people are think are good enough. What the approximation is also. Okay? So I'll mention at least two other ones that are significant for various reasons. One is from 2001 and is due to a group that was then at Bell Labs and has now moved to Harvard, headed by Capasso. And what is interesting here is that one of the potential application of or relevance of this issue is what are called microelectromechanical devices. That is, you want to now use your nanotubes, etc., to build things that are wires and conductors at the scale of nanometers. And at those scales, it turns out that you can't ignore these Casimir forces. They are very important. And actually, these people use Casimir forces to build a device. Basically, their device is, again, scales of tens of micrometers. This nano device is essentially a plate. They bring a sphere close to it, which generates a torque on the plate. And what they do is they measure the frequency of these oscillations and, again, relate the deviations or changes in frequency as this and plate get closer to each other to the Casimir type of force that is exerted. So Casimir forces are now being used to build these devices, or can be used, I should say. And if you noticed, all of the examples that I gave you so far, the force was measured between either sphere most of the time and a plate, or in one case, two cylinders. And it was only in 2002 that some of these parallelism constraints were resolved by Onofrio, who was at Padua and has since moved to Dartmouth, and they measured the Casimir force between parallel plates using interferometry to make sure that the plates, the two sides of the plates, are kept at the same distance from each other. And actually, one of the justifications that these guys sort of indicate as to why it is important to do Casimir forces is they have in the back of their mind testing things like does gravity hold to distances of the order of fractions of micrometer, etc., and potential tests of phenomenological string theory or other types of theories that predict something interesting happening at short distance scale because of extra dimensions or whatever, modifying gravity, you would need to be able to measure forces at these length scales, but then you need to know about all other forces that are operating in those scales, and Casimir forces are very important. So in order to really establish that you have actually measured some fifth force or some modification to gravity, you need to have a very good understanding of Casimir forces. So just what are some of the challenges to these high precision tests? Well, the one that is most appropriate to this workshop, and I'll be emphasizing, is really geometry. Is we started with the two parallel plates, but as Ilya pointed out, the experiments are either sphere and plate or two cylinders, etc. So how good is approximating the geometry as almost parallel plates and integrating over locally parallel plates, which is what people do for this? So there is an aspect of geometry that is really long scale. But there is another aspect of the geometry that is short scale. Actually, I should have shown you, or I intended to show you in context of this paper, that if you look at the surface that is supposed to be flat, It actually, these are gold plated. Typically the conductor that you have is you have a layer of gold deposited on the surface. They are actually quite at the level of nanometers rough structures. And so that's another aspect of the geometry, the roughness that you may want to worry about. So all of these things, in order to claim actually things at the level of 1%, etc., they have to correct for these effects by some phenomenological means mostly. The nature of your material, again, Casimir did the calculation assuming these idealized version in which the modes are quantized in exact units of pi over h, which means that your boundaries are ideal. Fields vanish exactly at the boundary. That means you have essentially infinite conductivity, zero skin depth, but that's usually not the case. So you have to put in properties of the material. Worst, maybe there are impurities, dipoles, or possibly even that are embedded in the material. How do you deal with that? And then the vacuum between the plates is probably never vacuum. You have a gas, usually, and you have gas particles at finite temperature. You also have photons that are thermally excited, and so you need to control all of these effects. Again, all of these are important things. My emphasis will be mostly on the geometry. Okay. So one way of thinking about this, rather than quantizing the modes, is to think in terms of quantum fluctuations. And essentially, you can say that in the vacuum that you have between the plates, well, you have electric fields and magnetic fields, but according to quantum mechanics, they're conjugate variables. You can't say that they are both zero. If one of them is zero, the other one must fluctuate largely. And so it is this uncertainty principle relating the electric and magnetic components that essentially is responsible for the fluctuations and the energy of the fluctuations. Now, when you go to finite temperature, there is another source of fluctuations that is not quantum mechanical, but is thermal. So let's ask completely classical question. Let us say that we have two plates and we have some kind of a fluid between them. And we are at finite temperature, so there are fluctuations in this fluid. Does that result in a force between the two plates? Well, if I do that with most ordinary fluids, like water, the influence of the boundary is felt inside the fluid only over a limited distance, which is called a correlation length. So typically, the interaction between these two plates would be there if you are within a few correlation lengths, but then would decay exponentially. So that's very weak, except that we know that in the phase diagram of a typical liquid or gas system, there is one point at which this correlation length goes to infinity. That's the critical point where you have critical opalescence, light of all kinds of wavelengths gets scattered, including wavelengths presumably that are of the order of the size h. And hence, when you reach that point, you expect that you will have more influence from one boundary to the other boundary. And what was pointed out by Fisher and Degen was that, again, just on basic dimensional grounds, you expect right at the critical point a finite piece to the free energy as a function of separation. Because it is due to thermal fluctuations, its scale is set by kT. kT having dimensions of energy, you took care of dimensions. Extensivity suggests that it should be proportional to the area of the plates. But to get the dimensions right, then you have to divide by 2 powers of h to cancel the length dependence of the area. And so there is this thing that you expect on dimensional grounds, and the only thing that you don't know is, again, the sign and the numerical value. And actually, the numerical value has the status of something like a critical exponent in two dimensions. as shown by Cardi. It is related to the central charge, close to four dimensions. You have to calculate it by an epsilon expansion.
Where is the dimensions here on the picture?
Well, I'm talking about three dimensions, but if you want to generalize it, you can imagine, yes, that's right.
Then it really belies it.
Yes, that's right.
Or the electron rate fields would be in three dimensions?
Oh, here I'm talking about a critical system. So you could, for example, put an Ising model or a Potts model in this geometry. Okay? So, now it turns out that there is a lovely experimental realization of this kind of systems, and that's in superfluid. Well, actually, let me describe for you the superfluid story a bit more. The phase diagram of something like helium, in addition to the normal liquid gas phase boundary at which you have the critical point, the correlation length diverges, you know that if you cool down liquid helium at some temperature, suddenly it becomes superfluid and you develop a condensed quantum phase, if you like, where this quantum fluid is characterized by a phonon or phase variable phi. And essentially, there is something like grad phi is like the velocity, and this is something like the kinetic energy of the superfluid velocity that is associated with these phonon modes. Now, if you have a theory such as this for the field phi, there is again no correlation length. So if there is no correlation length, if you again confine this field, the superfluid field between two walls, you would expect a free energy just on dimensional grounds that is exactly of this form. And in particular, since this is a simple Gaussian theory, you can do all of the calculations and calculate what this coefficient is. And actually, this coefficient also comes out if you were to do the normal Casimir force and raise the temperature to infinite temperature. The Casimir force at infinite temperature would be twice this because essentially electromagnetism has two components.
Uh-huh.
Yes. Yes. Well, the velocity should be zero. So grad phi should be zero. Yes.
How come this answer does not depend on the stiffness?
Because again, you took care of all of the dimensions. So that's why the Casimir force is interesting.
No, but its stiffness, suppose it goes to zero. What happens? There's no superfluid.
Yes, but there is a singular limit indeed that he points out when k is zero. And
the temperature ranging which is valid.
That might be like the Hall effect, where you can have a Hall constant which does not depend at all on the hopping to reach, because you have to wait till the fluctuation yields on the sun. So I don't know if it's the case.
Yeah, but I think it's a legitimate question. I'd like to be able to tell you that if k goes to zero, I have to scale it with some length or something. I don't think it's temperature, actually, because k goes to zero works even at sort of the range of temperature.
Right, becomes
frequency.
Frequency.
No. When k goes to
zero, I mean, those are all physically relevant questions. I guess what he's asking is a mathematical question. If I have this theory,
You have quadratic
del squared term. Okay, left with quadratic dispersion
relation.
You
cut
not on this equation.
You will correct
that
when
you
also
the
parameter,
which is
I know. Yeah, you are talking about a physical superfluid. I think what Ilya is asking is some geometrical theory. So this is the theory. This is the only thing that there is in the theory. For this theory, I can still make calculations.
So,
well, it is also in the infinity, but I think there should be some crossover function, which is k and some power of h that will take care of it, that you will see that. I think it's actually probably not h, but area. My guess is that k, there's some function of k and the overall area, because the modes are also quantized in that direction at some point, which we are not. I agree, there's hundreds of ways of getting rid of this, but the question is, if I just take this, put it in a box, and set k goes to zero.
Then it's an ultraviolet catastrophe.
Well, something controls that ultraviolet catastrophe, and I think it's the dimension of the box.
Yes.
K depends only on how close you are to the superfluid transition. It is proportional to the order parameter absolute value of psi squared, if you like, and it vanishes right at the transition. But once you are deep in here, presumably exponential or something like that. But that again doesn't answer the mathematical question. So there is no physical problem. There is a mathematical question. Okay. So setting aside unphysical limits, there is actually a very nice experimental realization of the system that was done several years ago by Garcia and Moses Chan at Penn State University. And the basic idea of their experiment is as follows. You have a bath of liquid helium, and you suspend above it a plate. It's actually a copper plate, and rather than one plate, it's a series of such plates, but none of that is important. Let's just focus on one plate. Then helium has the property that it is attracted to practically anything else more than it is to itself, because anything else is more polarizable. So the helium atoms here don't like their neighbors as much as they like the copper. So they jump ship, they leave from here, and they go up here. And one way of thinking about it is that there's a van der Waals attraction that builds up and makes this layer thicker and thicker. Of course, the further you go, then you have less attraction to the copper substrate, you're further off. So eventually, you stop at some point. And this point, this thickness D, is a competition of two effects. One is the price that you have to pay to move something from here to here against gravity. So it's proportional to G and the height that you have to go, and the depth of the film. So if you like, this is a chemical potential difference between the substrate here and the bulk liquid helium. And the reason you do this is because of the van der Waals type of attractions, which when you add up for all of the atoms here and all of the copper atoms, has a form that is 1 over d squared. So this is the coefficient of the van der Waals interaction. Integrating them falls off as 1 over d squared. And the standard theory says that you basically, this wants to make D small, this wants to make D large, you extremize, and you find that the optimal D is given by some formula such as this. This is sort of the zeroth order sketch. In principle, one has to include retardation effects, so this van der Waals term is slightly more complicated. Yes?
That's a conceptual question. I mean, yes. What's the reason to separate van der Waals from Bessemer at all? I mean, in principle, it's the same thing, right? Look at the properties of the medium that you're interacting with radiation laser.
Yeah, no, it's a kind of... they are all entangled together. Now, what is included over here and is the standard form is because of the dipolar fluctuations that you have for the helium atoms and the copper atoms. These these dipolar fluctuations involve excitations of the electrons from the ground state to the next excited state, and the typical scale of these van der Waals interactions are set by the delta E's that you have in the levels of the corresponding atoms. Okay? So they are not set by H bar and C. But actually, if you go and separate the atoms very far away, and you go from standard regular van der Waals to what is called the retarded van der Waals, then the retarded van der Waals is very similar to what's called Casimir quadrature. Okay? So in our case, of course, should the helium become superfluid, there is an additional force that is not covered by electromagnetism and is due to this phonons of the superfluid that I mentioned over here, which also give rise to a dependence on thickness, sorry, change of notation from H to D as I go to the next one, has a 1 over distance squared dependence. So should the film become superfluid, I have to add an additional contribution here. And so basically, the experimental situation is they take the film over here, or the system over here, they monitor the thickness as they lower the temperature. At some point, they hit this critical point. This is a critical point. And Fischer and Dejean told us that at a critical point, correlation length goes to infinity, you should have some effect. You lower the temperature further, you're no longer at a critical point, but you have these phonon fluctuations. So there should be another contribution over here. Okay? So what do they see? So this is actually their experimental setup. They have, rather than one copper plate, a series of copper plates. And what they measure is the capacitance between these plates that can be translated to the thickness of the medium that you have in between them. They measure the capacitance as a function of temperature. They see this dip. They convert that to a change in thickness, which they see has a form such as indicated over here. The interpretation is, again, that what is happening as you lower the temperature, at this point you hit the critical point, you get the critical Casimir effect, the thickness changes dramatically. Now you're away from the critical temperature, but you have the superfluid phase, so the thickness doesn't go all the way back to zero, but comes back to some finite change. So the interpretation that we would have for this curve, again, is no change of thickness in the high temperature phase, correlation at the critical point goes to infinity, correlation length, you have some critical Casimir effect, which is presumed to be large, but once you are below the Casimir, below the transition, you still have another fluctuation-induced force due to phonons, which doesn't allow the film to go back to the thickness that it had before. Again, the range of temperatures that we are talking about here is very small, so there is no way that the effect can be due to changes in the van der Waals coefficients, etc. It must be due to some macroscopic phenomena such as that related to the superfluid. Okay? So, why this reduction in thickness of the order of 4 or 5 layers? If we understand everything about this theory, we know the magnitude of this force. There's no free parameters. We saw that the stiffness vanished. So we know what temperature is. We know numerical values of zeta, etc. So we should be able to figure out exactly how much this film reduces in thickness. And you put the numbers, and the dashed blue curve is where you expect the film to be. So qualitatively, we seem to be doing fine, but quantitatively, we are not. We are not getting the expected value. So,
just this experimental data,
yeah,
falls on this line just above the transition, right?
Well, right at the transition.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But no, we expect this theory to be relevant when you are deep in the superfluid phase. So maybe there is some coincidence here. Actually, I'll come back to why that coincidence, if you like. But there's certainly something missing here. Okay. So we scratched our heads and we came up with the following thing, and maybe this is where stochastic geometry comes into play. Well, you usually do the calculations assuming you have flat plates, but what you have over here is a liquid whose surface could in principle fluctuate, right? So let's imagine that the surface of this film that is hanging from the copper substrate, rather than being flat, is deformed, and we can describe it by some function of h and t. In particular, the time dependence is very important, because the time dependence over here means that there is a velocity, and the velocity indicated by h dot for a superfluid, you have to relate it to the gradient of the phase of the superfluid. Okay? So we know that the velocity is zero at the substrate, is an amount that is set by this fluctuation at the free surface of the fluid. So we can solve the essentially divergence of velocity zero throughout this, and calculate how the velocity depends as a function of separation throughout. Calculate the corresponding kinetic energy, if you like. And essentially, the whole thing is set by fluctuations. So we can assume different fluctuating modes, if you like, capillary modes characterized by H of Q, characterize their contributions to the free energy. And once you are at the end of the day, calculate the corresponding force that is exerted from the derivative of this free energy, you find that it has exactly the same form. Again, dimensionally, it is very constrained. It has to be proportional to kT. It has to be proportional to area, and Hertz has to fall off with appropriate power of dimensions. And so then you have a bunch of numerical values, which when you evaluate are roughly twice or seven quarters of what Casimir force you had calculated before. So essentially, the thickness that you had over here, you multiply by three, and then you predict the change in thickness, which actually my red arrow I couldn't position correctly. It is falls much closer to where the experimental data is. So as far as we can tell, at least for this particular film, the behavior at low temperature is completely consistent with including.
Supposed to add this to the previous result?
Yes, because they are in the, there is one mode, which is the fluctuations of the field, and then this other mode that can be added independently to it. So you can actually, since the theory is quadratic, the two contributions are completely separate. Okay, and so everything works out fine, nicely. There was more work recently by the experimental group that is not published, so I won't go back to the preprint that I have. I'll go to the original paper. Essentially, you expect to be able to collapse all of your data for the change in thickness as a function of temperature if you scale temperature appropriately with some power of thickness and the correlation length exponent. And once they do that, they don't get a very good collapse, which was a puzzle to them. But more recent experiments, they did it with films that have less roughness, and they claim that the collapse improves. So let's essentially say that we have a curve such as this calculated for a variety of different thicknesses, and all of the data collapse. And so what I have been able to explain to you is the feature of this curve at the very lowest temperatures, on the low temperature ordered side. There is actually a theory by Kresh and Dietrich that calculates the high temperature behavior up to T lambda, and the experimental data agree very well with that curve up to that point. It's essentially just this little bit here. But then you would say there's a huge feature of this curve. This is the biggest thing that you can see in this curve, and we have no theory for that. So, something for people to think about.
So the actual expansion,
it's this, yeah. It's basically we are factor of 20, 30 off. Okay. So, thinking about roughness of surfaces is important. Maybe we should start doing it more systematically. So basically, rather than thinking about a completely rough surface, let's do some surface in which we sort of make a roughness that we control. We know what its wavelength is and what its amplitude is. And so basically, let's say that we have a kind of deformation that is characterized by some amplitude A and some wavelength lambda. Now, I mentioned that a lot of people do calculations where you have non-uniform, non-planar geometries, or even roughness. So how do they deal with that? Well, this is an approximation that actually goes back to Derryagin himself. It's called the proximity force approximation. Essentially, it says that we know the interaction between two flat plates as a function of separation, but the separation is actually fluctuating. So what we are going to do is imagine that the net energy is obtained by gluing lots of these pairs of surfaces at separations h that are parallel to each other. So we walk along x. At each x, we find what the local separation is, calculate the corresponding energy or force, and then integrate over all possible values. So if you are dealing with small fluctuations, such as the one that I'm here proposing, essentially what you will get is a correction to the leading behavior if the surfaces were flat. The corrections will be of the order of the typical magnitude of fluctuations, or the width of the fluctuations, dividing by the separation square. This is just what you would expect. For this approximation to work, h has to be much bigger than small h, that's true. But you are asking, when is this approximation justified? And it turns out that it is almost justified when the typical scale of variations is much larger than the separation. So we proposed that it would be good to do this kind of geometry, so people actually went and built this corrugated surface. This is again Mohyeddin and Roy. They measured the force this time between a sphere and one of these corrugated surfaces. If you use the formula that is over here, the proximity force approximation, you predict the solid line, and the actual measurements are different from that. And so what they claimed was that they have shown conclusive indication that this approximation is not good, although it's not entirely clear that they have, because there are some issues about, again, this being a sphere, where the sphere is located with respect to the maxima or minima of this potential, etc. So in any case, we did a calculation for this with M.A. Kanke and Golestanian, in which we said, how is the force modified if we have, say, a periodic modulation of amplitude A and wavelength lambda? If you use the approximation that I indicated over there, you would say that the correction is of the order of A squared over H squared. And indeed, we find that that's good enough approximation. in the limit where lambda is much larger than the separation edge. But for rough surfaces, typically you are in the opposite limit of lambda being much smaller than h, and there you find that the correction is actually, rather than falling off as 1 over h squared, falls off as 1 over h. This is still a perturbative calculation in a, so we got a squared dependence in 1 over lambda. Okay, so this, if you like, is exact in some particular limit. And just to give you an idea of why you would justify a 1 over h behavior, let's look at this picture. So let's imagine that we have two surfaces with a geometry such as what I've indicated here. If you use this proximity force, you're essentially averaging two separation, 1 over h minus a and 1 over h plus a. But in reality, you see that if you go in the limit where lambda becomes very small, then the surface below appears like a comb. Right? So you have a comb, and so then you have a plate and a comb. Well, electromagnetic wave is not going to go between the sort of slits of the comb. You would expect that in that limit, the effective distance, rather than being h, is the distance to the top of the comb, h minus a. So you expect in that limit the answer to be essentially h minus a to the fourth, and hence the correction is a over h. So it's a 1 over h correction independent of lambda. And the reason it is different from the correction that we have is that our correction a has to be the smallest parameter. In the other approximation, lambda is the smallest parameter. And so what I would like to know, and maybe somebody here can solve this problem and get the full dependence on a, h and lambda. And in particular, I would be happy just to see this in two dimensions. So this is a three-dimensional calculation. Let's say it's difficult. But say in two dimensions, we know lots of things from conformal field theory, etc. But can you solve this problem? So take one flat surface in two dimension, or line if you like, and another line, and calculate the finite part of the free energy as a function of that. And if you are ambitious, then maybe you can go from, rather than a sinusoidal curve, to some curve that is rough, maybe one of Ilya's Brownian SLE curves that are characterized with some kappa and some fractal dimension. Huh? Can we calculate those things in two dimensions? I guess so. This is three dimensions, but I would be happy to see that in two dimensions. Another physical consequence of this is I had one flat and one corrugated. Well, if you have two corrugated, you can see that there is another potential interaction, which is a force that goes sideways. And again, if you're going in the direction of building electromechanical devices, it may be good to also know about these types of forces. And so it is not surprising that this sideways force is going to be periodic. Essentially, the minimum energy is when the bottom of this is right on top of another one. And if you deviate from that, there is a periodic force. And you can compute that force, and you would have exactly that force if you just had pairwise interaction van der Waals. Point is that the dependence on various quantities, such as the wavelength, the amplitude, the separation, when you do it exactly, is different from what you would get from this proximity force or pairwise summation approximation compared to the exact result that we find. So it turns out that there are experiments. They do calculate this lateral force. But just as in the case of the corrugated plate sphere normal force, while as a matter of principle, the experiments can demonstrate that these pairwise approximations are not good enough, they are not yet in the range where you could say actually apply the formulas and the limiting formulas that we have for small amplitude deformations. So this is indeed a direction for which there is going to be improvement of experimental apparatus, and there is need for theory also to improve. And so the task, again, I sort of mentioned in two dimension, roughly is the following, that if I give you two particular shapes, calculate the energetics and the forces that are involved. Maybe this is a good time for a 5 or 10 minute break or whatever minute break. And if you like, I'm happy to continue. I don't know. I have the energy. I don't know if you have the concentration.
Take a break.
Contribution to the ground state energy of all of the modes, if you add them up, that again proportional to h bar c. It is proportional to the volume of the sphere, so it goes like r cubed, and again to get the dimensions right has to therefore fall off with separation as h to the fourth. And this prediction was actually experimentally tested by Hines and company for essentially a beam of sodium atoms that were going close to a surface. And so more recently also in some Bose-Einstein context. So this Casimir-Polder interaction between a sphere and a plate is again something that has experimentally been observed and agrees with the theory. Well, if you are going to build a wire, then maybe what you need to know is the force that you have between a cylinder, let's say of radius r at the separation h from a plate and the plate. So let's just make some guesses as to what this force could look like when you are in the limit where h is much larger than r. So let me give you some possible choices. Well, we know that the Casimir interaction between two parallel plates is proportional to their area divided by h cubed. So if you were to go by that analogy, you would say that the area or cross section that you see of the cylinder is proportional to rh, rl, where l is the length of the cylinder. But you say, okay, that's not a good enough analogy because that certainly doesn't work when I look at the sphere. The sphere doesn't go like r squared, it goes like r cubed. So maybe what I should go with is the volume of the cylinder. Volume of the cylinder is lr squared, and then you have to divide by h to the fourth. Say, well, maybe I should do a little bit better and use this proximity force approximation that I mentioned, which essentially looks at local separations h and averages over them. And then you get an answer that has some dependence on h and l that is somewhat like this. Well, last year with Thorsten Emig, Bob Jaffe, and Scarduccio, we calculated what the correct answer was in this limit for the cylinder. And it is none of the above. It is actually a power of h that is not even intermediate between what you would have between plate and sphere and two plates. It is something that falls off even weaker as 1 over h squared. Now, of course, we say that it should vanish as r goes to 0, as all of these other expressions vanished as r went to 0. Well, it does, but in a very non-power law fashion, as something like 1 over log of h over r. Yes?
So what are the boundary conditions of this?
This is an electromagnetic field.
With metals.
And metals, yes.
No penetration.
No penetration, yes.
So the Casimir Boulder is essentially, I mean, the reason the volume depends on his ability.
Yes, exactly.
Why is it not happening?
Good question. So, I said that essentially there's two alternative ways of looking at this problem. You can either think about the electromagnetic field fluctuating in between, or about the charges that are fluctuating on the bodies themselves. So let's go and think back to the Casimir Boulder. Well, you have a metallic object, it is neutral, so the only fluctuation that you can have is a dipole. You can have a local plus here and a local minus here. And then this dipole will create an image dipole in this plate. And what you would have would be an interaction between two image dipoles. So the typical interaction due to fluctuations is going to arise as to how easy it is to polarize the sphere, which is its polarizability that scales like its volume. Okay, now let's go to the cylinder. Cylinder is neutral. You want to create fluctuations on this, so what do you do? Yes. So what you can do on a cylinder and you can do on a sphere is to create these long wavelength charge separations. If you like, you can have a line of pluses on one half and a line of minuses on the other half. The whole thing would be neutral. Then essentially the image, one of the image situation would be another line which is essentially minus or plus. So locally what you will see essentially two lines of charges because of the fluctuations, and the interactions between lines are things that have these logs and things like that. So essentially the reason of this whole thing not being asymptotic, continuable from this dimension to this dimension is the nature of excitations changes. You have these long wavelength modes possible for the cylinder geometry that you don't have in the other geometry. Okay? So that's the limit. Actually, we can compute the whole dependence of energy and hence by extension force as a function of all separations. So not only in the limit where the separation is much larger than the radius, which is at this end, but throughout. And the reason that we can do this computation where the analog doesn't exist for the sphere is the following. So I said that Casimir and Boulder found the answer in the asymptotic limit of the sphere being very far away from the surface. And here we have the answer for all separation. So why is it that we can do something for the cylinder that you can't do for the sphere, or we can't do for the sphere? The answer is something that I already told you, that for geometries such as the sphere or my corrugated plates, one can decompose the electromagnetic field into transverse magnetic and transverse electric modes. Each one of them is effectively a scalar field, one with Neumann boundary condition, one with Dirichlet boundary conditions, each one of them easily doable through this formalism. And indeed, the two curves that you have over here with red and blue are our calculations for the Dirichlet and Neumann cases. And we simply have to add them up. Sorry, actually, the yellow is the Dirichlet, the blue is the Neumann, and the red is the overall or the sum. And we can do this for the cylinder. And the dots that you see is actually a numerical calculation that was done for the Dirichlet case, where one can sort of map to the problem to some Brownian path calculations, and they did Monte Carlo. And the result of that simulation that was performed actually only last year agrees very well, of course, with the theoretical computation that we have. Okay? So one thing that we can do further with this is to calculate finite temperature corrections, etc. But let me finish with one other interesting geometry dependence, which is that, again, I said that one of the motivations behind this is to try to build these nano-electromechanical devices. You want to build wires, etc. And then the Casimir force acts against you. because the force between your wires is attractive, and then the whole thing is in danger of collapsing upon you. So people would love to have a situation in which the force is actually repulsive rather than attractive. So the reason that people even think such a repulsive force may be possible has a story that goes back to Mr. Casimir himself. Back in 1956, about less than a decade after his original work on the Casimir force, he tried to come up with a model for the electron, generalizing classical pictures, Abraham Lorentz model of the electron, which was based on a conducting shell. So if you have your electron as a conducting shell and it has charge E and radius R, then there is the electrostatic repulsion that wants to blow it apart that grows as R goes to zero as E squared over R. Now, Casimir, having calculated the contribution due to these quantum modes of the vacuum for parallel plates, knew that the answer is a negative sign, is something that is attractive. So he hoped that if he were able to do the computation for a sphere and the modification of the modes, he would get a negative number. Dimensionally, he knew it should be proportional to h bar c. It has to be an energy, so you have to divide h bar c by the only length scale available to you, which is r. So then he said, if that is the case, we can stabilize by the Casimir attraction the repulsive electrostatic force that is trying to blow up this Abraham Lorentz classical electron model. And the only thing that we have to do is to adjust this A properly so that this is zero. And if you know the number A, actually setting this to zero will give you the value of a fine structure constant. So he even had an estimate of the fine structure constant interpolating what the answer was for parallel plates, guessing what the answer is going to be for the sphere. Okay, now this story was hanging around until in the 60s at Harvard. Boyer was a graduate student attending some lectures of Glashow on quantum field theory. And he mentioned this model of Casimir, and so Boyer set out to do this calculation, calculate the fine structure constant theoretically, and go and gather his Nobel Prize. So he sat for many years and did this calculation. Unfortunately, at the end of the day, the number came out to be negative. Okay, so it seems to make it difficult. So essentially, if you want to interpret this, it basically says that the Casimir type of corrections go in the same direction as the electrostatic. They want to blow apart your electron model. Now, this somehow led, in some people's mind, to the interpretation that Casimir forces can be repulsive. And so actually, there is even this proposal for a device to take advantage of repulsive Casimir forces to build an oscillator. And basically what you see here is that they have an interaction between a flat plate, and what you have down there is lots of indentations. And the reason for that is that it is not only for the sphere that you have this wrong sign, but in fact, if you go and compute corrections for the case of a parallel pipette with aspect ratios, let's say A and B, you find that as you change the ratio when you are in the regime between two B's that are kind of like a cube being more or less like the sphere, in that range, the sign changes. At short distances, it is attractive. At large distances, in that sense, it's also attractive. So essentially, what this thing is proposing here to do is to create an entity that when you get close kind of looks like a box in this region and will give you a report. Yes, does this work?
There are people that can prove theorems and this wrong sign is wrong.
I'll come to that. Yes. Yeah. So the difficulty actually with this is first of all, nobody has done the calculation for this with modulo what you refer to that I'll mention a little bit later on. And to interpret this as repulsive also for the case of a sphere, what does it mean? Because what you need to do is to change the aspect ratio, but once you change the aspect ratio, well, you have to keep either the volume constant or the surface area changes, and if the surface area changes, you have to pay surface tension, you have to deform the object, and the deformation energies are orders of magnitude more than what you would gain from this. So what you really want to establish is some kind of a geometry in which as you change, there is no change in the rigidity of the object, there is no change in the total area, etc. And so for that we came up with what we call a piston. So basically imagine that you have two of those boxes that we had before, you put them on top of each other, and essentially you have a movable partition. So clearly as the partition moves back and forth so that A changes, the aspect ratio in each box changes. Ultimately, actually, we will set L going to infinity so that we are really focusing on the lower box, but we keep track of the second box in any case, just to make sure that the total surface area, the total perimeter of the edges, none of these constants changes as you move the partition up and down. Okay? So this is a geometry where we can certainly go from something that is very much like parallel plates to something that is like a cube, etc. But we properly keep into track any effect from the lower part, region 1 and the region 2, add them up and calculate the net force. And once we calculate that, we get an answer, the curve that is always essentially attractive. So basically what is plotted here is the calculation that you would do for a single box, not thinking what is happening in the other region, and that calculation for the box changes sign, but the correct calculation that includes both of those and therefore is not subject to any changes in area or perimeter will always give you an attractive interaction. We can somewhat generalize that to go beyond boxes that were just simple rectangular geometry. And this is another case where geometry, which is one of the topics of this workshop, again comes into play. We assume that the cross-section that we have is an arbitrary two-dimensional curve. Here I put a hexagon, but it could have been any particular shape that you like, and we build a corresponding piston in that fashion. Now, the advantage of this type of geometry is that you can relate the modes of this box in terms of a product, if you like, of the modes that you would have for the two-dimensional geometry and the one-dimensional direction that is along the movable piston. And there are lots of known results for the density of states of solutions of, say, the Laplacian equation for an arbitrary shaped, say, two-dimensional object. Also for three dimension, there's a famous result from Balian and Bloch. And basically, we can use those formulas to calculate how the force is modified from the standard Casimir result, which is the area, cross-sectional area over A to the fourth, because of the shape of the box. And indeed, we find a formula such as this, which is related to the geometry of the two-dimensional curve through this combination of factors. I indexes the various corners that you have. Alpha I is the imperial angle that you turn at that corner. For the smooth parts of the curve, kappa is the inverse of the radius of curvature that has to be integrated, etc. So essentially, there is a correction to the leading Casimir force that is very much dependent on the geometry of the curve that you are looking at. And this dependence, you have a formula for, and for any smooth curve, you calculate this formula, your chi turns out to be 1/6. For a square, it turns out to be 1/4, which then brings about an interesting issue, which is, so how do you go from, say, a square? Well, in reality, presumably, you could have something that is like this. And the correction in one case, for the smooth case, is supposed to have a chi in that formula that is 1/6. If you regard it as a square, it has to be 1/4. Well, what does that mean? Well, again, it is really that you have to measure things with a resolution that is set by the height of this, how close your partition is to the base. So if these corners have some radius, let's say r, if you are at separations a that is larger than r, then effectively you see angles. If you go at resolutions a less than r, then it becomes smoothed. And so this curve will essentially cross over from one value to another value.
So there's no
perimeter
question?
Very interesting point. So basically, if you look at the density of states, there is a leading term that is area. The next correction is because of the perimeter, and then there is this correction. Now, it turns out that the density of states depends on whether you are dealing with Neumann or Dirichlet boundary conditions, and the perimeter has opposite coefficients in the two cases. So when you add up for the electromagnetism, Neumann plus Dirichlet disappears. But if I were to do only one or the other, there would be a perimeter correction. So it's actually an alternating series when you compare Neumann and Dirichlet. Okay, so I think what Ilya was referring to is what I would like to have is some more general results about impossibility of repulsive interactions. There is some effort in that direction. There is a paper by Kenneth and Klisch. And what they establish is that if you have two deformed surfaces, actually in their first paper, they have to be mirror images and there should be a mirror plane. There are two sides of the mirror plane. There will be arbitrary shapes. They show that there has to be an attraction. And actually, with Thurston-Emig, we have some other proof that more or less works in the same kind of limit. What I would like to see is, I mean, actually in those cases, you could very pretty much convince yourself that it has to be attractive because, as was mentioned before, there is very close correspondence between van der Waals types of interaction and these things, and if you have two objects, van der Waals interactions would tend to make them attractive. What I would like to see is some theorem that works in a geometry such as this one, which certainly is excluded by the theorem that they have. And I think it is possible to come up with some general results.
Aaron?
Yes?
How sensitive is all this to the ultraviolet structure? I mean, for real metal, there's the plasma frequency. And so is all this stuff really completely coming from the one wavelength stuff? And it doesn't matter how it's turned away. 0 point energy keeps going up.
So Yeah, so basically, in the calculations that we have done, we are assuming that the plasma frequency has gone to infinity, or if you like, it plays the role of the cutoff. For normal metals, at the separations that we are looking at of micrometers or nanometers, that's not such a bad thing. But just as a matter of principle, you would like to know what the dependence is on this cutoff. For simple geometries, such as parallel plates where you have an epsilon 1 of omega here, an epsilon 2 of omega, etc., you could do calculations via something that is known as the Lipschitz formula. So there's some result that are known about that, and people have calculated what corrections you would have to the regular Casimir interaction if you have some finite plasma frequency, or skin depth. But
are the results essentially independent of how the cutoff works? By fiddling around with the cutoff, can you actually significantly change the strength of the Casimir formula?
Well, I mean, all I can say is that for the standard parallel plate case, you can implement the cutoff by a number of different schemes. And essentially, the structure that typically you get is that, let's say, you have some domain. You get something like the volume of the domain, some characteristic cutoff length to the fourth power. You get some surface area, lambda cubed. Actually, this cancels out for different boundary conditions. And then you get perimeter, lambda squared, etc. And then you get ultimately the Casimir term that is independent of lambda. And this term seems to be independent of whether you impose the cutoff as a Gaussian or as an exponential. I don't know whether that has been done exhaustively or what one can say about that truth. Okay. So, just to summarize. So, we started by describing the Casimir force that started as a nice theoretical formulation, but nowadays it has been experimentally checked and is important for a number of things, electromechanical devices at the nano and micro scale, as well as if you want to do tests of new forces at that length scales. We saw that you can replace quantum fluctuations by thermal fluctuations and get similar effects, and that the wetting of helium films provides a very nice realization of such. I said that we can qualitatively describe what is happening below the transition and roughly at or above the transition, but can we describe the large dip that we have at the transition itself? So that's a puzzle. For corrugated surfaces, we saw that there are both normal forces that are corrected as well as lateral forces that didn't exist before, and these are different from what you would get by simple additivity pairwise type of assumptions or proximity force, and one needs to do a better job. We could do this for some perturbative limit, but it would be good to have schemes, either theoretical or numerical, that essentially can give you the forces for an arbitrary shape, because this is something that is within the range of experimental capabilities currently. The dynamical versions of this are nice to think about theoretically, such as the effective mass that depends on shape, dissipation in vacuum, radiation. But I think experiments are further away, and so devising possible experiments is the challenge in that. For the case of cylinder plate, we saw that we could find exact results and that the long separation limit is dominated by these long wavelength modes. We can compute finite temperature corrections, etc. And the next things that we can try to do is to look at multiple wires and such. And there is some change, I would say, in the sign of the Casimir energy that you would compute for spheres and pistons as you change aspect ratio, but in all physically calculable cases that we have looked at, the force is attractive, and it would be interesting to see whether one can rule out the repulsive force in general. It can exist for kind of mixed boundary conditions, but say for metallic plates, what I have in mind. And so before thanking you, I want to like to show this reference frame article that was written about 10 years ago by Dan Kleppner, which describes this analogy that I mentioned, this duality between looking at fluctuations of the electromagnetic field or charges, and then goes through the whole story and then concludes with saying that so what we have learned, first, that one must take the vacuum seriously, second, that intramolecular forces and slightly bizarre radiative phenomena have something in common, and third, that Casimir is pretty smart. That was written before Casimir passed away, but the sentiment remains correct. So thank you very much for your time.